music means that it's Monday morning, and it's time to get a look ahead at what's coming this week. So we've got our agenda with Charlie Herman, economics editor for The Takeaway and WNYC Radio. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
And also with us from his home in San Diego, California, Ruben Navarrete, a nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. Ruben, quite early for you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Let's start with you. Obviously, the Florida primary becomes tomorrow, and that's the biggest primary so far. The last time Romney was there in 2008, Florida was the end of his campaign, but it looks like it's going to be different this time around.
It does. He looks pretty strong coming in. I was in Miami just a couple days ago, which could explain the disrupted sleep patterns on my end. And he is strong. He's coming off a very strong debate performance. And I think a lot of the Republican establishment took Florida very seriously. This is the place they need to stop Newt Gingrich. They seem intent on trying to do that. The good news for Gingrich is no sooner do they leave Florida than they go on to Nevada, and he may do a lot better there. For reasons we can get into later. But I think Florida is going to be a very strong state for Mitt Romney.
Well, let's talk then about Gingrich's chances in Florida, because we all said that Mitt Romney was sure to win South Carolina. Remember that?
Right.
Any
exactly.
chance Gingrich will upset this?
Gingrich has a lot of good grassroots support, for sure. I think in the Hispanic community, which you can't say enough of in terms of Florida, here you have a population that, say, is 22% of the Florida population. It's a new game, different game from Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. You can tell that from what the candidates are talking about. There, Gingrich has very strong support in the grassroots level, and Romney's done a lot to sew up the Hispanic establishment figures. So it would be a mistake to count Gingrich out. Gingrich is also sending all the right signals to his donors and his supporters. Hey, I'm going to be here for a long time. I'll be here for the next 6 months or so. This is not over, and I'm not going to surrender. So he's a wild card for sure. He should not be taken lightly.
And it's certainly not going to be the end of Gingrich's campaign, no matter what happens in Florida. Let's move to Nevada, though, as you hinted earlier. The state will caucus on Saturday, and you say it's a completely different story there.
It really is, because you have another state with a big Hispanic population, a bigger percentage of the population than you had in Florida, 22% in Florida, about 26% Hispanic in Nevada. But there it's a different game, because you're not talking about Cuban Americans, you're talking about Mexican Americans. Mexican Americans who are much more likely to give both Republican candidates, but especially Mitt Romney, a really hard time for his hardline positions on immigration. So what he didn't get, the thumping he didn't get from the Hispanics in Florida, he may well get come Nevada.
And that's partially because of not just his criticism of Gingrich and his so-called amnesty plan, but also the discussions over the DREAM Act, where Latinos in general have not been satisfied with basically anything that the Republicans have been saying about the DREAM Act, but particularly Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney's got out of his way to say, you know, I would veto this act if I were in power, if I were president. And the DREAM Act obviously would allow students who go to college or join the military to have a pathway to legal status if they're undocumented. It's supported by 80% of Hispanics, both Republicans and Democratic Hispanics. And Romney stuck his neck out and said, no, I would veto that. Not a good move if you want to court Hispanics. Secondly, the main thing that Romney has done when he attacked Rick Perry and later Newt Gingrich, he always goes back to this narrative of Hispanics as takers. Takers, takers. They come here for freebies, right? They come here for free stuff. They come here for in-state tuition and free benefits and the like, welfare benefits and the like. They never come here to go to Massachusetts and do Mitt Romney's lawn, which is exactly what happened. So illegal immigrants do contribute a lot. He hasn't been honest about that. He'll pay for it.
That's Ruben Navarrete, nationally syndicated columnist to the Washington Post Writers Group, and Charlie Herman, economics editor for The Takeaway, WNYC Radio. Let's talk a little bit about this economy, whomever contributes to it or doesn't, because we got this rate of 2.8%. That's how quickly the economy grew in that last quarter of 2011. Good news, mediocre news, or bad?
Mediocre. You know, the economy continues to grow, so that is a good sign. It's better than what we saw before that. But often when you come out of a recession, you sort of expect a lot faster growth. And so this is...
But we haven't seen that in anything.
We haven't seen that out of coming out of this recent recession. And you need that sort of growth to really get jobs created. And without those jobs being created, unemployment will stay high. And that makes it difficult for the president to get reelection or to use the economy or look what I've done for the economy to get reelected. You know, again, that slogan we've talked about before of it could have been a lot worse doesn't really ring for those people who are out of work. And it doesn't really ring... true in terms of trying to get people to see him in a positive light. if he wants to get reelected. It also gives the Republicans something to hammer him on.
Although the narrative seems to be changing among economists, and you can disagree with me, absolutely, but when I read the way that they're describing it now really is about a slow recovery now, that the trends are all very, very slightly trending upward, and that appears to be pretty stable.
Yeah, exactly. And if trends keep going the way they are, then yes, theoretically, we'll see unemployment continue to come down. We could see more jobs created. But there's just a lot of factors that we don't know. This is where we were last year, for example, and then the earthquake in Japan happened, something that we didn't anticipate at all, and that had a global effect on how economies were growing, especially in Japan, but in other places as well. So a concern would be what happens in Europe. That's where the worry, that's where the earthquake could come, you know, and if something like catastrophic happens there, then does that end up slowing us down here just enough that we don't see the sort of growth that we need? I mean, it's steady, but it's not exciting.
All right. Well, we have a procedural vote in the Senate going on among the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. This isn't getting a lot of coverage, but I'm wondering if you could tell us exactly what this Stock Act does.
At its basis, it would stop congressional leaders from being able to do insider trading, information that's been legal? Basically, it's one of those things that's not legal, but they have been allowed to, or it hasn't been very clear that they – about this issue, that they obtain knowledge just in the course of doing their job, and then
The president mentioned this in the State of the Union
after 60 Minutes did a piece that highlighted, you know, prominent Republican and Democrats who appeared to be benefiting from insider knowledge.
Oh, yeah, that's bipartisan.
Well, it's become bipartisan. You know, you've got Scott Brown in Massachusetts as well as New York Senator Gillibrand, who are pushing this through the Senate. And then over on the House side, you have Eric Cantor, who's pushing a version there. So it looks like this is gaining momentum. It would be a legislative ban prohibiting insider trading. And, you know, this is an idea of really to try and restore some faith in Congress, because when you look at how bad the poll numbers are, this is yet another thing that says, you know, people look at them and say, wow, and you can trade on insider information and you don't get prosecuted for this. And yet another reason for me to dislike you. And so this is, an attempt to try and right that wrong and improve the ratings a bit.
Yeah, I can't imagine it's going to take too much of a dent out of that very low approval rating for Congress.
1 or 2% can help.
Thank you, Charlie Herman, economics editor for The Takeaway and WNYC Radio. And thanks to you, Ruben Navarette, a nationally syndicated columnist with the Washington Post Writers Group. That's your agenda. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One more story now that's certainly going to be setting the agenda on Wall Street, if not nationally, or at least globally, to 500 million people who actually log into Facebook every day. Charlie Herman, economics editor for The Takeaway. Stay with us.
I'm here.
Now, there's probably some Hollywood filmmaker somewhere who turned a school project into a serious career, right?
Yes.
And some original Silicon Valley innovators who built some stuff with soldering irons that might have produced a $1 billion business or
yes.
so. But if Facebook goes public on Wednesday and they claim that they're going to, the valuation of what?
The valuation of the company?
Yeah.
It's going to be valued $75 to $100 billion.
$100 billion. So Zuckerberg is clearly the global leader in turning a school project into a lucrative sort of a gig.
It would have a value of McDonald's, basically.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, first of all, what has to happen before the actual initial public offering, and why is it taking so long, do you think?
Well, so they have to, you know, line up the banks. They have to line up the buyers. They have to sort of figure out the exact price that the stock will be offered at. I mean, a lot of the sort of the mechanics of it. Once that happens, which there are reports, the earliest it could be this week from the Wall Street Journal, although they've dialed that back a little bit. But there's going to be a lot of chatter, a lot of, you know, how much money are they going to raise? The estimates are about $10 billion. So this is a huge amount of money. This could be one of the biggest overall IPOs and perhaps the biggest tech IPO in the United States that we've ever seen. If you compare it to Google, which was just in 2004, when they went public, they raised just under $2 billion.
Wow.
Facebook is looking at $10
billion. That's
amazing.
And
Google was valued at the time at $23 billion and Facebook at about $100 billion. So just how big this company has become. You know, the funny thing, though, about this is they're going public. Part of the reason is, you know, you get to a point where people are trading in shares that are non-publicly disclosed
right,
shares.
Right.
If you get to a certain number of people trading, you have to go public. And they are getting close to that level.
So there are two ways of looking at this, and let's explore them. One is they've reached a point where they kind of have to.
Exactly.
Which is kind of what you've alluded to there. But there's also sort of an evolution, the kind of the vision of the company means they have to. But this is also an economic indicator. They've decided that this is the perfect time to do so. Is that an endorsement of the tech economy right now or the investment economy right now?
I think that is probably an endorsement of Facebook right now, that,
really?
Of where they're at and the strength that they have. Because one of the trends that we're seeing that has been pointed out to me by a lot of people who study the numbers and crunch them is that there's actually been a bit of a decline in venture-backed tech companies having IPOs. And this is an important issue because you want these companies to go public because when they do, they raise a lot of money. That money goes back to their initial investors, and those investors then have money to then invest in other companies to get those companies off the ground and growing. And those investors, it's often money made up of stuff like pensions and healthcare plans. They get paid back. Now, with this decline, what you're seeing is that if fewer companies are going public, that means you're creating less jobs. So that's a job issue right there as well, getting these companies public.
Although some have said that Facebook waiting has stalled the VC money because they've been wanting – the investment money for IPOs has actually been waiting for Facebook. And so once this is out of the way, maybe the floodgates will open there.
Maybe the floodgates will open. You know, one of the complaints I've heard, and you often hear this from companies, it could be the market. It could be Facebook. Another one is just all the regulations that are out there now, whether going back to the Sarbanes-Oxley rules a couple of years ago to recent regulations that for really small companies that are trying to go public, not the Facebooks of the world, it's really, really difficult.
And Zuckerberg hates paperwork. We know that. Look for a feed on the Facebook site of the stock. Actually, probably. There'll be a little bug that shows what the stock is trading at.
Well,
who knows? They can work that out.
Friend the stock price.
Friend the stock price. There we go. Charlie Herman, economics editor for The Takeaway on a possible IPO for Facebook as early as this week.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.